This is CHUO 89.1 FM. Welcome to this week's episode of The Mosaic, your weekly show highlighting the voices of the community. Here, we guide you through today's social issues, introduce you to changemakers, and keep in touch with the arts, music, and events of the city. You can expect extensive research, in-depth analysis, and discussion. From CHUO's news team, this is The Mosaic. Tomorrow is International Women's Day. This global event celebrates the social, cultural, economic, and political achievements of women. We on The Mosaic are proud to highlight these achievements of women in our community. For International Women's Day, we're going to be airing some of our favorite segments showcasing female voices, intelligence, and accomplishments. To kick us off, we'll head back to early December. At this point on The Mosaic, we'd covered the 82nd anniversary of the Battle of Hong Kong. The date came a few weeks after the death of the last Canadian veteran that survived this battle. The Canadian War Museum held a panel to discuss the Battle of Hong Kong and the lesser-known history of what happened after it. Over 1,900 Canadian soldiers were imprisoned in Japanese prisoner of war camps in what led to one of World War II's longest incarcerations. For nearly 4 years, the troops faced horrible conditions, including starvation, beatings, and abuse. Montreal-based documentarian Viveka Melki spent years researching this piece of Canadian history. She'd interviewed fellow historians, experts, and survivors. That research boiled down to a documentary called The Fence, released in 2022, which the panelists discussed at the museum. I spoke with Viveka afterwards to discuss her methods of storytelling, feminist filmmaking, revisionist history, and interviewing veterans. Here's that conversation.
I was at the panel last week, which marked an 82nd anniversary for the start of the Battle of Hong Kong, which is huge and monumental, and also unfortunately came about a week after we lost the last veteran who survived as a prisoner of war.
Yes, when we just forget.
Right, yeah. So we got to see some clips there from The Fence, and I want to talk to you so much about this film because it is so wonderfully put together, and it's a story that not a lot of people actually know about. In your work, you like to focus on topics that are often overlooked. This took like 10 years of research for you.
Yes, it did. It was research was very difficult on this film. For a number of reasons. We know that the Asia-Pacific War was not as documented. That's a lie. It was documented. It was not classified. So we have documents that are in archives in various places that have not been classified. So it's not easy to find. Because I always say about history, I don't have an arrogance of saying, oh, I found something. I found something because it was digitized. Okay, so those before me were probably looking for it also, but we live in an age where it's easier in a way to make history, right? And so it started with these letters of Colonel Jack Price that I was reviewing and researching and scanning. And I started to feel like there were strange things in the letters. There were things not being said. And so I started to go online and reach into amazing networks. There's a POW research network online that you can go and find people who were US, Europe, Canada, and they're posting archives of their families. There's GUWLO, which is Elizabeth Ryde's website. There's all these amazing, what I would call amateur historians who are gathering information or who had family members who were in this conflict. And so they are starting to put their stuff online. So that's how I was researching. Sort of grassroots, you would say. Mm-hmm. And I would reach out to people and I'd be like, would you share your story? And like in our film, for example, you see those shots of the parachutes dropping the food. That came from a blind pilot in the United States who was a veteran who had actually kept those images when he was actually dropping those food drops. So it's quite amazing. Like the research in the film, the archives come specifically from actual people who were there. And then in that image, you see it's a classified document from the army that, of course, has been released now. So, yes, that's why it took 10 years. But beyond that, I started to see stories, what I call in between the lines. And I know I called the film The Fence because it's about black and white and what's in between. which of course we know Shamshipo prison was. We rebuilt the POW camp exactly to size and scale, and there was a space in between either side. And so what I'm interested in between the lines of these documents is what was sort of not being said, was ashamed to be said, or had sort of disappeared from history.
Yeah, really, really casting light on those shadows. And then that research in grassroots, like you said, almost like the truest sense of the word. And I guess you kind of mentioned it started with looking over these letters and looking over like families' accounts. What got you there?
I think I'm very interested in how trauma is passed down in multi-generations. I know it's a huge issue in our Indigenous communities that, thank God, we're talking about now a lot more. It's also, for me, a huge issue in war trauma. And I knew that Japan had a revisionist history as its model. I had seen the history books that did not mention Japan as an aggressor and did not mention any of the POW experience. And that was disturbing. And so I'm seeing it as someone in this generation. In our film, we have Dr. Kwong, who is this amazing historian. He's of my generation. And that was my point, is that who are we today in this generation? What are we hearing? What's being transferred to us? And what is not being transferred? And what does that feel like? And we actually ended up going to Hiroshima, going to the museum. You see the kids at the museum in the film, because it was shocking to me. It was like being in a parallel universe where this story didn't happen. And my broadcaster was the CBC, and I want to say I was really lucky to have such a good broadcaster. And I remember speaking with my commissioning editor, and we said, if you erase their history, then you erase our history also. It's not like you can be in Japan and erase that history. You're erasing our existence at the same time. And so I really came to the story trying to say what had not been said. And we have to understand that the veterans in our film, I had been to see them several times. And that was that story came out slowly. It came out in brackets, and it took a lot of trust to tell us that story. This was a story that had a layer to it that I had not seen in my work with the European War. I hadn't seen it with the Korean War, the Vietnam War. There was something in this that was almost shameful. And what was the shame? What is it that you were so ashamed of that you couldn't tell us? And in my opinion, it comes back to what George Peterson says. When they came back, nobody believed them. They couldn't believe them. That was like the first thing. They didn't believe them. They went to doctors, they told them what happened, and they were literally not believed. So they stopped talking.
Wow.
So I was really trying to have them talk again.
Right. And after all those years, you'd imagine it gets harder and harder to talk about it. But building that trust and rapport was very important for you. And I think it gave a really incredible moment. You mentioned at the panel that one of the survivors shared an experience with you that was incredibly traumatic. But after that, they slept fine for the first time in their life after being a prisoner of war. I actually read this book about a bunch of journalists who share their like favorite stories where they really did something incredible. And there's a CBC journalist named Red Sharon, and he also brought a Canadian prisoner of war back to Nagasaki. And I think that was in like 2015. He said the same thing though. It was really hard to get that veteran there because of all that trauma and that history that was really painful. But after he was there, and as emotional and hard as it was, he also slept fine for the first time in his life after that too. I think that there's something really interesting there, and I'm wondering if you can tell me more about what you think about how sharing this and sharing your story, how that goes to heal trauma and wounds.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think that's a very good question. I think that I am of the school of thought that says that it's okay that trauma happens to us. Childhoods that have had trauma, lives that have had trauma, make for people who are resilient, strong, empathetic. Not that we wanted that to happen to people, but I am not a person who says that that's sort of the end of a life. Or I think healing from that trauma is a responsibility, not just for us, but for our families and our children. And we live in a society where that is available to us. I will hesitate and say that the cost of that is way too high. a lot of people cannot afford the therapy that they need. You just have to look at those who came back from the Afghanistan war. You just have to look at our modern wars. And it's better now. But when George came back from war, there was nothing offered for him to go and heal that. So I do think I am of the school that says that speaking about your trauma, sharing it, doing PTSD therapy, doing, you know, regressive therapy, whatever it takes to make you live your best life after that experience. I'm also someone who says that trauma never goes away, it is with us forever. However, we learn to live with it as we learn to live with PTSD. So I think it's fantastic that people can talk about their trauma. I find that it needs to be actually where our space is, as in here in our company, we do ethical storytelling. And that is a place that acknowledges your trauma. If you're dealing with material as a journalist, as a filmmaker that is traumatic, then we are providing you a healing to do your work, to keep doing your work, but to try and do it in the healthiest way.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you about that too, that trauma-based reporting, because as a filmmaker, you also mentioned that there were some things that you chose to leave out, because when the subject of, you know, sexual assault was brought up and alluded to, you don't need to give the gory details about that. But I'm assuming that after 10 years of research and all these interviews, there must have been a lot more that you were pondering keep or cut. And I kind of want to hear your take on...
Asking a great question. The question you're asking is how much of the horrendous treatment did we cut? And we cut a lot. And this is not something that someone brought up at the panel, but I'm glad you're bringing it up now. We chose to keep certain stories in the film from our veterans, like the story that George Peterson says about babies on bayonets. Babies on bayonets is a contested historical fact by Japan. We didn't do it. It didn't happen. The Chinese have gone as far as to dig up graves to prove it. George Peterson tells us that story, having seen it at the fence. So the reason I kept the particular stories that you see in the film are because it's part of the narrative of the film of revisionism. We cut the stories that were horrendous because we had to make those decisions, but because we felt that those stories were not moving this story forward. Every time we make a history film, we try and move it forward. So what were the stories that George had spent his life suppressing, not sharing, and that had also been part of revisionism? So we put those stories in the film because we're like, okay, if we have 10 of these and they were awful, if we have 10 of these stories, then which are the ones that are going to actually help either heal, move forward, support? Because for me, that's the purpose of a history film. It's not to make history, it's to move the conversation forward and tell it in the time that we live in, which is the time of you and me, not only the methods we use, but the voice we're allowed to have. And so that's why we picked those particular stories. But yes, Lauren, we had many awful stories that we did not put in the film because we sometimes felt they were too much for the audience to hear. And even the ones that are in there now have caused concern. They were not easy. And honestly, I can't begin to say, I mean, I work with a number of broadcasters. I can't begin to say how huge it was that the CBC let us make this film. Mm. They supported this film because that's enormous, which is, I know it's a time of way too much movement. I know it's a difficult time at the CBC, but that should be the mandate of a national broadcaster, is to tell your history and to tell it true without any government controlling what you're being saying and who you're going to offend. So, you know, it was amazing. And even the veterans came forward after and said, it's amazing that you were able to tell the story.
Wow.
Because we felt we couldn't have that voice and tell those stories for a long time.
That's amazing. And I wonder, was that decision, like, all those decisions along the way. How difficult was that, especially when you said yourself this history is something that has been revised in the past? Are there things that you really, really wanted to get in there but thought the audience might not be ready for it?
The most difficult decision was not history. It was the Hong Kong situation. That was the hardest thing to put in the film. We had finished making The Fence when the Umbrella Revolution occurred in Hong Kong. We had one more filming to do just to finish the film when that occurred. And I made the decision to integrate that into a film that was about World War II. And the reason I did that was because I felt that we were talking about democracy. And democracy was a theme in the film. It was an important one. And I asked the consent of the family of George if it was okay that the statement he's making about democracy is put over a modern conflict. Because even that is a decision, is a consenting decision. So that was a difficult choice, because I know that there were those who didn't support me doing that. But as a POV, as a point of view Canadian filmmaker, I have my politics, and I'm honored and privileged to have that voice. And I was there 2 weeks before it all went to hell. And it's the most terrifying time. And the fact that I got on a plane and left that, I will never forget that feeling. And I love Hong Kong, and I felt I had to speak up. Because I could. And I felt that democracy was disappearing again.
You don't have to answer this if you're not comfortable, but can you tell me more about that experience before you left?
Yeah, those streets were absolutely empty. You know, there was nobody on the streets. You know, Lauren, I can speak freely. I will never go back to China, and I will never go back to Hong Kong. Those places are gone for me. And that's okay. If this was the price of it, that's okay. It was a terrifying time, because until you've seen democracy disappear, you were watching it disappear in front of you. Now, I come from a country that had a dictator for a very long time, which was the Gambia. That's where I'm from. And so I've seen a non-democratic society. But what I was watching this time was I was watching it disappear. And that was a shocking thing to see. And it goes slowly, and it goes in pieces. And it was really hard to watch this society that was so advanced lose its voice. And so I stayed in the hotel most of the time. I only went out to shoot what I had to. And then I left with the footage, and I knew I was never going back.
Wow. And yeah. Of course, that's something that you touch on in the documentary, and you share these stories of these veterans. You also share the story of a woman named Luba. And I wanted to ask you more about how you got in touch with these veterans and how you got in touch with Luba, because it's pretty incredible what you did. Can you touch
Luba
on
Estes.
That?
Luba Estes. I hope she's listening. Luba Estes is an amazing woman. She lives in the United States. And I have to tell you something really funny. Luba used to work for the CIA. So when I arrived to interview Luba, she interviewed me. Which was really funny, because I got a full CIA drill. It was fantastic.
That's an interesting experience.
Luba's amazing. She's an amazing woman. So Luba's father, Alexander Skortsov, does the drawings, which she turned into a book later in life, but he makes 100 copies of these drawings, and he gives them to 100 people. And one of them was Jack Price. And it's signed to the three leaders of the three regiments that were there in the front of the book. And so we then started looking. These drawings are incredible. They were in the Jack Rice collection. And I was like, okay, who is Skortsov? Who is this person who did these incredible drawings? Because again, in a place that has no history recorded, they were showing starvation, a map of Hong Kong, things that could have got him killed. We call every Luba Estes in Florida. We find a tiny article on this woman who had a father in the camp. We trace back, we call every Luba Estes, was your father Skortsov? And finally, this woman with a fabulous, fabulous mix of Russian-British accent answers the phone. And we fly down and we go and sit with her, and we spend a long time. She's an amazing person. And she tells us the story of how she was this child living in Hong Kong. Now, many things about that make it fascinating. And why do you insert it in a Canadian company, Canadian story? But the fact is that Luba was living the reality of Hong Kong proper. And for me, it's very important to have the Chinese side of the story, because we lost 291, but they lost 50,000. So it's not only, right, about us going to a country and hoping that we're going to help, and who are the people who suffered and how did they suffer? And so that's the other side of the fence, of course. And this Luba ends up being a stateless person living in Hong Kong. So she's able to tell us what's happening in Hong Kong because our POWs are inside the camp. They don't know what's happening outside. In fact, that's one of the things that's awful. They're either in the battle or then afterwards they're inside the camp. But Luba's actually living in Hong Kong. And so we're able to see another side of the story. I think what I'm trying to say is Luba brought perspective to history. And what I love is I am definitely a feminist filmmaker, and I like to put the voices of women forward and how they experienced war, because I think women suffer war, but they're not often the voices of war. And so that's why we have Luba, who's also one of the central characters. In fact, you'll see that we had an actress who was doing reenactment, and it was incredible because she actually, Luba, like, was astonished. She moved like her. She looked like her. It was incredible. So it's about bringing women's voices forward also in history.
Right. And you're right. She was wonderfully spoken. She's got a beautiful voice. And I actually remember watching the film. There's like a moment where the light casts a shadow on this birdcage behind her and it spreads back. And it's just such a beautiful image. And I guess the younger actress who portrays Luba in these scenes, she moves like her. And you mentioned that you wanted to keep wardrobe and props in the set as authentic as possible. You know, the fence, and it was to scale. So what's the importance to you about keeping things as authentic as possible as a documentary maker?
Yeah, absolutely. That is a focus for me, much to the chagrin of my crew, who is under pressure. This is revisionism. And in a history that's already got shadows around it, confusion, archives that have been hidden for years, voices that haven't been heard, I think our duty is to at least get it as close to accurate as possible, at least to take you into a world that is as respectful of that disappeared history. And so we had an amazing crew who understood that right from the beginning and did everything they could to help me get actual archive pieces that were shot in the film. But when I break those 100-year-old Christmas balls that smashed to the table in the film, it broke my heart.
Oh my God.
Those are actual Japanese Christmas balls that are 100 years old.
Wow.
And I sacrificed them
for this film. So you really want to get that take.
Yeah, you really did. On our Instagram, you actually see us doing that shot because it was like you had three. We had some fake ones to bounce from Walmart, and then we had the real one, and that was it. But we had this amazing director of photography, Claudine Sauvé. The film was actually nominated for its photography, and she was amazing because she was so respectful of how I was really trying to get this absolutely right. But I remember the tinsel, everything was absolutely perfect because I wanted to give them back something that had been taken, which was that this is not being erased, at least because a film becomes a document, right? A film goes into schools, a film becomes something that is an existing piece of history in a way. And so at least we could do our best to get it right.
Mm-hmm. The attention to detail is immaculate, and those years and years of research really show. I have so many geeky questions about the nitty-gritty details that go into the making of this film, because you have incredible archive footage in there, and you mentioned some of it even comes from survivors themselves. Can you tell me a little bit more about the journey to get that archive footage for the film?
Yeah, I'd like to tell you about compassion, actually, because compassion is a big part of this film. Let me go one step further to explain that the chrysanthemum flowers that you see in the film that Luba's actually eating, they would pick the chrysanthemums and eat them. The chrysanthemum flower is the flower of compassion. It is also the flower of the Imperial House of Japan. So that's how far I went in insisting that we had the national flower in the film. So there is an amazing group called the POW Research Network of Japan. They are in Japan. They are made up of Japanese professors and historians who are determined to tell the truth about their own history. It is thanks to them that I got the image of the Christmas dinner. There's a Christmas dinner scene, and they are the ones who had it for us. So what I want to say is I was very clear that my issue was with the history books and the right-wing government of Japan. That was my issue. it is not with the Japanese people or with the amazing historians who were already there, like Dr. Tanaka in our film, who were determined to tell this story. So it was with their help that we were able to get that Christmas scene with the goat. It's actually this picture that's taken, and it is the actual picture, and we got it from them. And they will go and do research within Japan, within archives, to bring forward this story. And their hope is that this kind of truth-telling makes their society stronger. Because how is vulnerability a weakness? To be vulnerable is to actually have strength. And so to be able to say, this is our story, this is what we did. The other incredible thing that I did was I was in contact with somebody who I'm actually not going to share her name, because she's actually concerned about her safety in Japan. And she has the last interviews of the Imperial Guards of the army. And so I listened to many, many hours of Imperial Japanese guards who were telling us what they did and what happened. It's really important to me to actually hear those stories and to see the other side, and then to journey past that into compassion and understanding. And that's where in the film you see us talk about starvation and the starvation of the troops. And 80%, I think is the number, died of starvation. They were sent from their own country by their own government, and then they starved. And so there has to be, I think, when we retell history, it's not black and white. There has to be some compassion. But it was with those people in Japan that we would actually go, and we were actually looking at firsthand archives, journals, and everything else.
Mm-hmm. Like completely immersed in the history there.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how did that play into your conversations with these veterans?
Lauren, you asked very good questions.
Thank you.
Because that was not always a conversation. I think that when you have a story, when you're George McDonnell or you're George Peterson, I met about 15 veterans. They were still alive at the time. When you have your story, and your story is one that you've told for a long time, and it's very clear, and it's the way you saw it. When I arrive with Luba's story or Dr. Tanaka's story, it's maybe not the place. My place then is to listen to your story. What makes us film directors and point of view film directors is we put all that together and we make a narrative that has many sides. But when I was with the veterans, my key focus was supporting them, listening to them, not re-traumatizing them. And if there was a re-traumatizing that occurred, supporting them after. That takes a lot of time. And that is very good. It's ethical storytelling. But it takes a consciousness that does not stop when the camera's off. And so I had mentioned to them that Luba existed, that I had been to Japan. But George Peterson, for example, did not really want to hear me talk about my views on Hiroshima today. He already knew. They know what's happening to the history. They know what's in the history books. And it's painful to know that your suffering is not even mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So there's such a huge element of truth-telling in the films that you make. If I can take it back to the beginning, when you were deciding that you wanted to get into filmmaking, what was the vision at that point? Did you know that this is the kind of documentary you'd want to be making?
Not at all. Lauren, when I came to Canada, Canada Immigration did not want filmmakers. They asked me, could I go and do something else? Because I really didn't need any more artists. I think about that when I'm sitting on the stage at the War Museum. And I went into something else. I think it was marketing and communications. So I was there doing that, surviving for a long time. It took me 10 years to become Canadian, a really long time. But I was determined. This was the country I had chosen. It wasn't just an accident. So back then, no, I didn't know that truth would be the narrative of our production house. Now, just to make you laugh, Viveka means truth.
Really?
So my father must have known what he was doing. But yes, truth is very important to me. You know, we say that a filmmaker is making one film their whole life, and all our films focus on truth, but on resilience. Human resilience is huge. And I think my African upbringing is a reason why. I was in a revolution myself. I've seen enormous amounts of suffering. I am a survivor of many things myself. And so I feel that human resilience is actually what fascinates me. But if you want to heal, come back to that, I think we have to tell the truth. And tell it to yourself, tell it to someone who's listening, but from there the healing can begin. So I actually, Melky Films, all our films are on truth telling, but healing attached to it. I think it's what I hope for our society. I think it's what we need.
Mm-hmm. And I'm running out of time here, but I just wanted to close on saying that you do have a newer film and it's more about sex trafficking. Could you tell me a little bit more about that?
Trafficked Voices just came out on CBC, and it is on sexual human trafficking in Canada, which is, again, something that's hidden and people don't know. But Lauren, I'll tell you, we're making 3 films on trafficking in Canada. The next one comes out next year on the TELUS National and also on Radio-Canada. So the fact is, it's a big enough issue that we made 3 films on it.
Wow, major. Well, thank you for sharing that with me. Is there anything else that you'd like to add right now?
I just want to say I really enjoyed this interview because your interest in history gives me hope.
Thank you, Viveka. I really appreciate your time.
In the summer, The Mosaic covered International Overdose Awareness Day. Canada alone sees an average of 22 deaths per day from opioid toxicity. In Ottawa, Kayla Haggerty has founded the Solidarity Alliance of People Who Use Drugs to create support for people experiencing or affected by addiction. The group advocates for improving harm reductions to mitigate the overdose crisis. I spoke with Kayla in August about her advocacy, and here's that conversation.
My name is Kayla. I'm 24. I'm going to Carleton to do a master's degree in sociology, and I'm working under the supervision of Aaron Doyle right now. And my thesis is focused on how the pandemic impacted the opiate epidemic. Part of that research was kind of inspired by like my own personal loss. My dad passed away in May 2020 from an accidental opiate overdose. And so kind of since then, I've been focusing my research on that topic and utilizing my life experience to kind of make my research a little bit stronger, making like community-based research projects like podcast, documentary. Then I'm making a part 2 to that documentary right now for my thesis. And then, yeah, just like working with the communities that I've always been a part of and bringing them into like a more academic setting.
Wow. So your advocacy began when you lost your dad to this crisis. And then since then, could you tell me a little bit more about the work that you've done focusing on addiction and mental health and overdose awareness issues?
Yeah, for sure. With the group that I started called the Solidarity Alliance of People Who Use Drugs, we do like little outreach events. So we'll get people clothing, food, connect them with harm reduction resources. And then later on today, from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. at Dundonald Park, I'm hosting our first International Overdose Awareness Day event. And it's like a candlelight vigil. So I'm trying to get as many folks as I can to come out to kind of like light a candle for their loved one, kind of say maybe a few words for them. And then we all just like hang out, have coffee and donuts. And yeah, I'm trying to create a space of healing and grieving kind of through all of this.
Are there many other organizations and events like this in the city that help to reduce the stigma of this conversation?
A little bit. There's a couple of them. I know Sandy Hill also is hosting another International Overdose Awareness Day vigil at 11:30 in the morning today. Organizations like Sandy Hill, Somerset West, those kinds of things, they do practice harm reduction principles. And then there's also just like grassroots organizations as well across Canada that are doing that. Indigenous Harm Reduction out in Toronto does really good work. I guess my organization, we're trying our best. We're still new. It just started in January 2023. So, and then CPEP too, Criminalization and Punishment Education Project, they're always out there trying to do things. So there's a couple organizations that talk about this stuff, but I feel like it does need to be talked about more. It's still kind of being pushed under the rug, especially the connection between like the increase in overdoses and COVID. I don't think a lot of people like to talk about that, but yeah.
And then on that note of like the stigma and awareness and having this conversation, when you started your research to now, have you noticed a change? Like, are more people talking about it?
Yeah, for sure. When I first started in 2020, there were like barely any academic articles or like barely any conversations being had about this stuff. It was more like just the grassroots individuals or people with lived experience that were saying, hey, like something's wrong here. We need to start looking at this. And now more articles are coming out. More articles are being published every day, talking about the same topic that I'm talking about in my thesis. And yeah, and I find that organizations now that went through the pandemic, like Sandy Hill, are now realizing the impacts of those drawbacks, I guess, during the pandemic on their service. And they're kind of like trying to pick up the pieces since then. So I think the conversations are being had. I just don't know if the solutions are being created.
Mm. And then you also mentioned that you've got firsthand experience with people who have lived these experiences combating with addiction and mental health issues. And what do they have to say about services like this that you guys provide?
Yeah, I feel like a lot of what people are telling me is that there's not enough. I guess when you want to walk into something, you want to see yourself there, and that'll make you more comfortable. And so the push right now is for people with more lived or living experience to be part of the roles. Like right now, my role is a harm reduction worker, and you are not supposed to be actively using when you're a harm reduction worker, and you need like a college or university level education. And a lot of people don't have that, but they do have the harm reduction education and experience from their own lived experience. And so they get kind of pushed to the side or not included in these opportunities. And so a lot of the folks that I talk to are driven to push those narratives and kind of make space for people like them, which is kind of what I'm trying to do anyway, too. But yeah, it's just making sure that people with lived experience are included in like creating the policies and procedures, implementing the programming, giving the programming, things like that. Yeah,
Exactly. And then having this experience, hearing from them and doing this research, what have you found from how COVID has exacerbated this issue?
There's a couple things. I always split it into three just because it makes it easier. But the first thing is like the increase in mental health and addictions difficulties, especially during the isolation when we had like a stay-at-home orders and lockdown. The second thing is business shutdown. So a lot of people were like seeking, I guess, support and treatment and the other options as well as safe injection sites and all of those things. Their capacity was pulled back. And so less people were able to access those services. There were no public washrooms, like things like that, that really affected people. And then border closures as well. I think border closures had a lot to do with like the increase in drug precarity, like the toxicity of drugs right now. I think it was harder for people to get their products that they were used to in. There was a lot of like shortages, like there was a meth shortage. There was a couple things that like just people could not buy. And so they had to try something else. And yeah, and I think that increased like the overdose rate as well and just like tainted the drug supply even further.
And what do we know about how toxic and lethal these drugs are?
From my research, I'm just getting it from like Health Canada and like talking to people on the streets. And a lot of the drugs right now are laced with things like benzodiazepines and xylazine, which is like a veterinary tranquilizer that's not made for humans. And so when people do overdose, they could have a fentanyl overdose, yes, or an opiate overdose, and we can Narcan them. But then they'll be fine from the opiates, but the tranquilizers and the benzodiazepines will keep people asleep for like 4 to 6 hours. And like we're unable to rouse them because like the sedation is so strong. That's been a big change. I'm not really sure if there's like any studies being done to see if there's like a reversal drug for xylazine or benzodiazepines and things like that. Things that make people like tranquilizers really. But right now that would be really needed because that's been a big change. Just like people don't know what drugs they're using anymore. And I think part of why the conversation around safe supply is so important, because then people would know what they're taking and would know like the dosages and would know how much they need. And they wouldn't have to use precarious or dangerous drugs on the streets.
And I'm kind of running close on time here, so I'm going to wrap it up shortly. But just lastly, if there was somebody out there who was listening, who was experiencing addiction, or maybe they lost a loved one to an overdose, what would you have to say to them?
I think I would just say, like, kick in the doors that don't open for us. I think a lot of our problems are because we aren't included in the conversations that are being had about what we need and what our families and loved ones need. And so like making sure that you put yourself there, or at least build a community where you guys can communicate and come up with solutions amongst yourselves, just because this isn't going to get better until we all come together. And it can't just be the loved ones of people who have lost drugs that have empathy and consideration. We need like everyone, people who haven't had have experienced this kind of grief too, as well, to include people and give people what they want. Yeah.
Did you have anything else that you wanted to add for the vigil tonight? Like what that might look like?
If folks want to come out, it's Dundonald Park. It's 516 Somerset West, right across the street from Art House, and that Tim Hortons on Somerset. So you should come join us, come cry with me, whatever works with everyone. That's about it though.
Okay. Thank you so much for taking the time today.
Yeah. Thank you for speaking with me.
Barbara Leimsner is an Ottawa-based author. In September, she held her first book launch at the Ottawa Public Library. In her autobiography, she writes about growing up with a Nazi-sympathizing father, moving to Canada, and ultimately learning to turn away from the hateful propaganda she'd been exposed to as a kid. She embraced activism in the 60s and has continued her advocacy to this date, currently speaking out against racism, transphobia, and homophobia. I spoke with Barbara after the launch, and here's our conversation.
On Saturday, you had this book launch for your new book, this memoir, Quitting the Master Race. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
Yes. So the book launch was the official kickoff for this book. And I think it was a great success because I was able to fill the room. I got lots of good feedback from the people who were there about how they were receiving the book and so on. Yeah, it was a very successful event. It was interesting, the disparate groups that came out, including everything from people concerned about the rise of the far right to people who had lived through the Second World War, possibly some people of German ancestry and so on. It was very interesting. We had a question and answer session that raised a lot of really good questions.
And what were some of those significant questions?
Well, people wanted to know, for example, was my father a Holocaust denier? That was one question. Also, what was the nature of the German community in Canada in the 1950s? You know, were there significant pockets of fascists? That was pretty interesting. Questions about how to oppose the far right today, the balance between compassion for my father and anger in the book. Did I achieve that balance? How did I achieve it? That kind of thing.
And I'm sure you've got a lot of answers sprinkled in the book as well. So I would like it if you could tell me a little bit about it and that journey that you went through to kind of free yourself from the hate that you encountered as a child.
All right. Well, let's start talking about my immigrant story. This book is about me as a kid. I came to Canada with my parents when I was just about 4 years old. And of course, immediately, my father, having been so inculcated and indoctrinated with horrific fascist ideology when he was in the military and also before the war even began, started to share those same views with my sister and I. And they were racist views. They were ultra-nationalist views. There were certainly notions about our own superiority as pure-blooded German people. And it was, at first, I craved my father's approval as a little kid. I didn't really know any better. And it's a bit horrifying to think that, you know, young kids are very impressionable and easily led, especially when they look up to their parents. And so I was no exception. And it took several years going to school, of course, hearing what other parents were saying or not saying, for these kind of ideas that I'd grown up with to jar in my head with what I was learning at school. And also, I think key is the civil rights movement in the 1960s was starting to become, in full throttle. That was critical because my teachers and everyone else supported the struggle for equality for African Americans. And I was generally sympathetic and so on. And yet my father's racist ideas said, oh, Black people are at the bottom of the heap. And also that the races shouldn't mix. So white people and Black people shouldn't mix because, of course, that had been Hitler's notion, Aryans and Jews, Aryans and Black people and so on. And so these ideas started to jar in my head. But I sort of, I wasn't necessarily preoccupied with them and so on. So it really wasn't until I got to university, I would say, and started to really see, well, first of all, I was learning completely different things in my classes. And I had roommates from all over the world and friends from all over the world. And I, at some point, concluded, which I write about in the book, that my father was, and I say, completely full of shit. So I also was myself caught up and became an activist in the 60s in the student movement, which was happening on the campuses here in Canada. Early 70s, when I got to Carleton, there was still a big wave of progressive movements. There was women's movement, all kinds of things you could do and encounter and be involved in. And so I was in there like a dirty shirt. And was really drawn to left-wing activism, which I think made all the difference.
Mm. And so like during that Q&A period, you mentioned that people asked you about, is it hard? You want to sympathize for your father, but he's got these awful Nazi sympathizing views. You confront this painful history and you've refused to leave out the hard stuff, and you wrote that amnesia is too convenient. So what was it like for you to personally confront your family's past like this?
I won't say that it wasn't very, very difficult. Even when I started writing the book, and I wasn't necessarily clear exactly where I was going with these stories, I really harbored a big knot of shame in my own body. You know, shame about that past, my father's views, and also guilt too, to some extent. And I think that's not uncommon for my generation, the post-war generation. And I wasn't sure I wanted to go public and tell this story. I had started writing it in 2016 after taking a course at Carleton in the Learning and Retirement Program, or the Continuous Education Program, called Remembering My Father. And that was the year that Donald Trump got elected. And if you recall, in 2017, there was a Unite the Right rally at Charlottesville in Virginia, where violent fascists, neo-Nazis, Ku Klux Klan members, Proud Boys, Heritage Front folks, and so on, were coming together, including from Canada, were coming together and waving torches and chanting all kinds of rubbish like Jews will not replace us and all of this. And Donald Trump, the white nationalist in the White House, was saying that they were fine people, just fine people. And, you know, I think it was then that I thought, wow, can this happen again? Is it possible that we're going to see a resurgence of this kind of, you know, neo-fascist kind of movements and populist movements? And I was horrified, and it created a sense of urgency for me. I thought, you know, if I have any doubts that my family's story matters or telling the story matters, I need to just push ahead and get this book done and get it out there, because I think it does matter. Even though it's one family story and it's an author probing into the past and looking at parents and how they became indoctrinated, ordinary people like my parents, they were not high up Nazi officials. They were just ordinary folks like your neighbor. And they became indoctrinated and bought on to a horrendous ideology. And we see this now in the States and in Canada here, where large numbers of millions of people believe that an election was stolen. Conspiracy theories, lies, Obama wasn't born in the US, and on and on. There's the notion of a great white race being replaced by deliberately flooding Mexicans across the border and immigrants into the country and refugees and so on. These are lies, and they're becoming more mainstream. And that is exactly what happened in the 1930s, when preposterous notions, anti-Semitic notions and so on, entered the mainstream.
Wow. So this book comes at a really important time. So in your years and years of activism, you're finding that today there is a very significant resurgence of right-wing extremism?
Yes, I think so. And we don't have to look far. We had, I mean, here in Ottawa, for example, we had the convoy, which was led. It was not everyone in it was by any stretch, far right or fascist or anything like that. At the same time, the people who organized it certainly were. They had definite links to far right groups and ultranationalist groups and so on. And it also showed how groups like them can use a crisis like the pandemic to mobilize large numbers of fearful, angry people into the streets in a reactionary way. And that's what we saw with the convoy. So similarly, I mean, I participated this summer in two protests when the far right came to picket at Broad Street School. And they also picketed at the National Arts Center to prevent parents with their children from going in to hear Drag Queen Story Hour, which has been happening here in town for 10 years. And so seeing those emboldened far right in your face kind of actors here in Ottawa, it tells us that no country is immune, including here in our own city, from the pernicious effects of people who will take advantage of the fear and insecurity and anger that a lot of people feel and project them to the right.
Mm. So this polarization that's going on, this emboldened hate, people look back at the Holocaust towards the 30s, where you say that kind, these kind of sentiments were happening. And people like to say never again. But after your research and analysis, how can we prevent hate like this from really spreading?
Yes, I think that's a really, really good question. And it's actually the key question to some extent. I think, first of all, people do need to get informed and realize that when they are getting lies, you know, online lies about all kinds of issues, including, for example, that trans people are groomers and pedophiles or some such nonsense, that people really get informed and look behind the scenes at what really is happening. So that's the first thing. But the second thing really is, and what I really stress in my book, is that for ordinary people, you know, most people are not the extreme far right that we're seeing right now. But for ordinary people, really, the key thing is to see and to experience large community mobilization whenever these kind of far right actors show their faces and march in cities or hold events or so on. I think they need to be opposed at every turn. And also that means people organizing through their unions, if they're working in a unionized workplace, through their workplaces, through their community associations, through their universities, and actually making sure that there's a broad-based community anti-fascist response. What we saw in the 1930s and what enabled Hitler was the passive bystanders, the people who weren't big high up monkey mucks in the Nazi party, but, you know, and many people did support the Nazis. There's no question about it. But there were also large numbers of people who stood by and let the fascists run their course. It also has to be said that once Hitler got into power, and this is in the history books, but that the first people who were in the concentration camps were the anti-fascist opponents of the regime, who were numerous. So leaders of other political parties, Democratic Party, Social Democratic Parties, the Communist Parties, and so on, those were the people who were the first people who were locked up in the camps, because Hitler believed in exterminating his so-called enemies. Many of them perished, and it became much more difficult to mount resistance, even though there was still low-level resistance, once that party got into power. And so, I mean, that's a lesson from history too. We have to just prevent them from ever taking the reins.
Mm. And that, to me, it connects to this quote that you have in an excerpt from your book, where you're writing about your dad, you're figuring out about his complacency and sympathy for Nazi ideology. And you write that he was a product of his times, but he was not a passive victim. Right. Can you speak a little bit more on that, as that complacency as being linked with violence?
Mm-hmm. My research really helped me explain how my dad, growing up where he did in that particular region in northern Moravia, in the former Czechoslovakia, how people in that region became ultra-nationalist and ended up supporting Hitler even more so than some people in West Germany proper did. So I came to understand the propaganda that he was exposed to, what it was like to be a soldier for 7 years in Hitler's army of annihilation, which was brutal. So yes, I could understand this, but my father always had choices. Everybody does. You know, I said in the introduction to the book, I'm not trying to exonerate my father. There was no reconciliation between my love for my father, you know, my German papa, and the authoritarian views that he held. That those two things cannot be reconciled. He was, yes, a victim of his times, but he was also an actor in history, as we all are. We all are actors in history. And so it wasn't like people got swept away into a big wave and none of them made choices. They all had to make choices every day about supporting the regime or not, or passive resistance. You know, I think that's important. I tried to portray him, and I think I succeeded eventually, you know, with some humanity, rediscovered the humanity that he had with some compassion. But that's different from exonerating him from holding those abhorrent ideas.
Mm-hmm. And I think the reviews can attest to that depiction. I was looking them through and it looks good. You're earning major praise for thoughtful honesty. What were some of your fears and hopes when you were writing it, though?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess, I mean, there were definitely lots. I would say, you know, one of the fears would be that, you know, maybe some people would misunderstand writing a book like this as an attempt to exonerate the parent or exonerate the ideas. But that, I think it's very clearly an anti-fascist book. I hope, you know, no one could mistake that. I'm hoping that the book, one, finds a broader readership, that it reaches people who both are concerned about the rise of the far right today and those who have some experience with that history and maybe had parents or grandparents in the war and, you know, want to discuss the lessons that have come from that history that may have been lost to a newer generation. So it's really about having discussions and hoping to generate conversations. At the same time, I'm also hoping to mobilize people to some extent, to convince people that standing by and watching because it doesn't affect me right now is not an option if we want to preserve the liberal democracy that we live in. It can be easily lost. And without people standing up, it will be lost.
Well, Barbara, thank you for taking the time with me today.
Thank you, Lauren. I appreciate it.
And that's it for this week's episode of The Mosaic. Thanks so much for tuning in. Music for The Mosaic is by Helizna. To listen to this episode and previous ones, go to chuo.fm/podcasts. If you're interested in joining our news team, email news@chuo.fm. We'll see you next week, Thursday at 1 p.m.